Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Planet of Viruses, 3rd edition, by Carl Zimmer, narrated by Stephen Bowlby. Foreword. Viruses wreak chaos on human welfare, affecting the lives of almost a billion people. They have also played major roles in the remarkable biological advances of the past century. The smallpox virus was humanity's greatest killer, and yet it is now one of the few diseases to have been eradicated from the globe. Emerging and re-emerging viruses, such as those that cause influenza, Ebola, Zika, and now the global COVID-19 pandemic, pose global catastrophic threats and extraordinary challenges. These and other viruses will likely continue to threaten human well-being. A better understanding of these viruses will help us to prepare and prevent future viral diseases and pandemics. Viruses are unseen but dynamic players in the ecology of Earth. They move DNA between species, provide new genetic material for evolution, and regulate vast populations of organisms. Every species, from tiny microbes to large mammals, is influenced by the actions of viruses. Viruses extend their impact beyond species to affect climate, soil, the oceans, and freshwater. When you consider how every animal, plant, and microbe has been shaped through the course of evolution, one has to consider the influential role played by the tiny and powerful viruses that share this planet. After the first edition of A Planet of Viruses was published in 2011, viruses continued to surprise us all. The Ebola virus, once limited to small flare-ups in remote parts of Africa, exploded into massive outbreaks and, for the first time, spread to other continents. New viruses, like MERS and SARS, leaped from animals to humans through zoonotic infections. HIV, first recognized in 1983, has now infected almost 38 million people throughout the world. But scientists are also discovering new ways to harness the amazing diversity of viruses for our own benefit. Carl Zimmer has drawn on all these developments to produce this new edition of A Planet of Viruses. Zimmer originally wrote most of these essays for the World of Viruses Project as part of a Science Education Partnership Award, SEPA, at the National Institutes of Health, NIH. World of Viruses was created to help people understand more about viruses and virology research through comics, teacher professional development, mobile phone and iPad applications, and other materials. For more information about World of Viruses, visit worldofviruses.unl.edu. Judy Diamond, Ph.D., Professor and Curator, University of Nebraska State Museum, Director, World of Viruses Project. Charles Wood, Ph.D., Lewis L. Lair, University Professor of Biological Sciences and Biochemistry, University of Nebraska, Director, Nebraska Center for Virology. Introduction. A contagious living fluid. Tobacco mosaic virus and the discovery of the virosphere. 50 miles southeast of the Mexican city of Chihuahua is a dry, bare mountain range called Sierra de Nica. In 2000, miners worked their way down through a network of caves below the mountains. When they got 1,000 feet underground, they found themselves in a place that seemed to belong to another world. They were standing in a chamber 30 feet wide and 90 feet long. The ceiling, walls, and floor were lined with smooth-faced, translucent crystals of gypsum. Many caves contain crystals, but not like the ones in Sierra de Nica. They measured up to 36 feet long and weighed as much as 55 tons. These were not crystals to hang from a necklace. These were crystals to climb, like hills. Since its discovery, a few scientists have been granted permission to visit this extraordinary chamber, known now as the Cave of Crystals. Juan Manuel Garcia Ruiz, a geologist at the University of Granada, was one of them. After studying the crystals, he determined that they formed 26 million years ago. At the same time, molten rock was rising up from deep inside the earth, building the mountains. Subterranean chambers took shape and filled with hot, mineral-laced water. The heat of the underlying magma kept the water at a scalding 136 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the ideal temperature for the minerals to settle out of the water and form crystals. For reasons that aren't clear, the water stayed at that perfect temperature for hundreds of thousands of years. That long simmer allowed the crystals to grow to surreal sizes. In 2009, another scientist, Curtis Suttle, led a new expedition to the Cave of Crystals. Suttle and his colleagues scooped up water from the chamber's pools and brought it back to their laboratory at the University of British Columbia to analyze. When you consider Suttle's line of work, his journey might seem like a fool's errand. Suttle has no professional interest in crystals or minerals, or any rocks at all for that matter. He studies viruses. There are no people in the Cave of Crystals for the viruses to infect. There are not even any fish. The cave has been effectively cut off from the biology of the outside world for millions of years. Yet, Suttle's trip was well worth the effort. After he prepared his samples of crystal water, he gazed at them under a microscope. He saw viruses, swarms of them. There are as many as 200 million viruses in every drop of water from the Cave of Crystals. That same year, another scientist, Dana Wilner, led a virus-hunting expedition of her own. Instead of a cave, she dove into the human body. Wilner had people cough up sputum into a cup, and out of that fluid, she and her colleagues fished out fragments of DNA. They compared the DNA fragments to millions of sequences stored in online databases. Much of the DNA was human, but many fragments came from viruses. Before Wilner's expedition, scientists had assumed the lungs of healthy people were sterile. Yet Wilner discovered that, on average, people have 174 species of viruses in their lungs. Only 10% of the species Wilner found bore any close kinship to any virus ever found before. The other 90% were as strange as anything lurking in the Cave of Crystals. In caves and in lungs, in glaciers in Tibet, and in winds flowing high over the mountains, scientists keep discovering viruses. They're finding them faster than they can make sense of them. So far, scientists have officially named a few thousand species of viruses, but the true total may, by some estimates, reach into the trillions. Virology is a science in its infancy. Yet viruses themselves are old companions. For thousands of years, we knew viruses only from their effects in sickness and death. Until recently, however, we did not know how to join those effects to their cause. The very word virus began as a contradiction. We inherited the word from the Roman Empire, where it meant, at once, the venom of a snake or the semen of a man. Creation and destruction in one word. Over the centuries, virus took on another meaning. It signified any contagious substance that could spread disease. It might be a fluid, like a discharge from a sore. It might be a substance that traveled mysteriously through the air. It might even impregnate a piece of paper, spreading disease with a touch of a finger. Virus began to take on its modern meaning only in the late 1800s, thanks to an agricultural catastrophe. In the Netherlands, tobacco farms were swept by a disease that left plants stunted, their leaves a mosaic of dead and live patches of tissue. Entire farms had to be abandoned. In 1879, Dutch farmers came to a young agricultural chemist named Adolf Meyer to beg for help. Meyer gave the scourge a name, tobacco mosaic disease. To find its cause, he investigated the environment in which the plants grew, the soil, the temperature, the sunlight, but he could find nothing to distinguish the healthy plants from the sick plants. Perhaps, Mayer thought, an invisible infection was to blame. Scientists had already discovered that fungi could infect potatoes and other plants, so Mayer looked for fungus on the tobacco plants. He found none. He looked for parasitic worms infesting the leaves. Nothing. Finally, Mayer extracted the sap from sick plants and injected drops into healthy tobacco. The healthy plants turned sick. Mayer realized that some microscopic pathogen must be multiplying inside the tobacco. He took sap from sick plants and incubated it in his laboratory. Colonies of bacteria began to grow. They became large enough that Mayer could see them with his naked eye. Mayer applied these bacteria to healthy plants, wondering if they would trigger tobacco mosaic disease. They did nothing of the sort. Scientists have since learned that plants are coated in bacteria from their leaves down to their roots. Far from making plants sick, many of the microbes help them thrive. And with that failure, Mayer's research ground to a halt. The world of viruses remained unopened. A few years later, another Dutch scientist named Martinus Beijerinck picked up where Mayer left off. He wondered if something other than worms, fungi, or bacteria was responsible for tobacco mosaic disease, something far smaller. He ground up diseased plants and passed the substance through a filter so fine that it blocked all the cells it contained. He was left with a clear, cell-free fluid. When Beijerinck injected it into the healthy plants, they developed tobacco mosaic disease. And when Beijerinck filtered the juice from newly infected tobacco leaves, he could pass the disease on to more healthy plants. In 1898, Beijerinck described his findings, referring to his filtered juice as a contagious living fluid. It carried something inside it that spread tobacco mosaic disease. That substance was living, Beijerinck assumed, but it had to be different from life as he knew it. In the late 1800s, researchers were confident that all living things are made of cells. His fluid contained none, and whatever it did contain must be remarkably durable. Beijerinck could add alcohol to the filtered fluid, and it would remain infective. Heating the fluid to near boiling did it no harm. Beijerinck soaked filter paper in the infectious sap and let it dry. 3 months later, he could dip the paper in water and use the solution to sicken new plants. Beijerinck gave a name to the mysterious agent in his contagious living fluid, virus. He borrowed this ancient word and gave it a new meaning. Yet Beijerinck could not define what a virus actually was. All he could do was say what it was not. It was not an animal, a plant, a fungus, or a bacterium. It was something else. It soon became clear that Beijerinck had discovered just one kind of virus. In the early 1900s, other scientists used his method of filtering and infecting to discover other viruses that caused other diseases. Eventually, they learned how to cultivate some viruses outside of their hosts. If they could grow colonies of cells in a petri dish, they could grow viruses too. Even then, scientists still couldn't agree about what viruses actually were. Some argued viruses were parasites that exploited cells. Some maintained they were just chemicals. The confusion over viruses was so profound that scientists could not even agree if viruses were living or dead. In 1923, the British virologist Frederick Twort declared, "It is impossible to define their nature." That confusion began to disperse with the work of a chemist named Wendell Stanley. As a chemistry student in the 1920s, Stanley learned how to make crystals by combining molecules into repeating patterns. Scientists could learn things about molecules in their crystal form that they could not otherwise. They fired X-rays at the crystals, which bounced off the atoms and then struck photographic plates. The X-rays left behind repeating patterns of curves, lines, and dots, which scientists could then use to determine the structure of the molecules in the crystal. In the early 1900s, crystals helped solve one of biology's biggest mysteries. At the time, scientists knew that living things contained puzzling molecules called enzymes, which could precisely break down certain other molecules. To figure out the true nature of enzymes, scientists turned them into crystals. The signature of their X-rays revealed that they were made of proteins. Thinking of the transforming power of viruses, Stanley wondered if they were made of proteins too. To find out, he turned viruses into crystals. He chose a familiar species for his work, the tobacco mosaic virus. Stanley collected the juice of infected tobacco plants and then passed it through fine filters, as Bergerinck had done 4 decades earlier. He removed every bit of contamination from the fluid and then prepared it to crystallize. To his amazement, tiny needles began to form in the fluid. They grew into opalescent sheets. For the first time in history, viruses had become visible to the naked eye. Stanley found that his virus crystals were rugged as a mineral. He could store them away for months, like table salt in a pantry. When he then added the crystals to water, they vanished from view, becoming a contagious living fluid once more. Stanley's experiment, which he published in 1935, dazzled the world. "The old distinction between death and life loses some of its validity," declared the New York Times. But Stanley's work, while groundbreaking, had its limits. For one thing, he made a small but profound mistake. Tobacco mosaic viruses were not made of pure protein. The British scientists Norman Peary and Fred Bawden discovered in 1936 that 5% of the virus's weight was made up of another molecule, a mysterious strand-shaped substance called nucleic acid. Nucleic acids, scientists would later discover, are the stuff of genes, the instructions for building proteins and other molecules. Our cells store their genes in double-stranded nucleic acids, known as deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA for short. Many viruses have DNA-based genes as well. Other viruses, such as tobacco mosaic virus, have a single-stranded form of nucleic acids called ribonucleic acid, or RNA. It would take decades for scientists to discover how viruses use this genetic material to take over cells and get them to make new viruses. And while Stanley saw viruses for the first time, he only saw them in droves. Each crystal he created might contain millions of tobacco mosaic viruses nestled together in an interlocking grid. To see individual viruses, scientists first had to invent a new generation of microscopes, ones that use a beam of electrons to reveal tiny objects. In 1939, Gustav Kausch, Edward Fankuk, and Helmut Ruska mixed tobacco mosaic crystals into drops of purified water and put them under one of the new devices. They could see minuscule rods, each measuring about 300 nanometers long. No one had ever seen a living thing anywhere near so small. To contemplate the size of irises, tap out a single grain of salt onto a table. Stare at the tiny cube. You could line up about 10 skin cells along one side of it. You could line up about 100 bacteria. And you could line up 1,000 tobacco mosaic viruses end-to-end alongside that same grain of salt. In the decades that followed, virologists went on to dissect viruses to map their molecular geography. While viruses contain nucleic acids and proteins like our own cells, they use these molecules in a profoundly different way. A human cell is stuffed with millions of different molecules that are in constant quivering motion, cleaving each other apart or bonding each other together, which the cell uses to sense its surroundings, crawl, take in food, grow, and decide whether to divide in two or kill itself for the good of its fellow cells. Virologists found that viruses, as a rule, were far simpler. They typically were just protein shells holding a few genes. Virologists discovered that viruses can replicate themselves, despite their paltry genetic instructions, by hijacking other forms of life. They inject their genes and proteins into a host cell, which they manipulate into producing new copies of themselves. One virus goes into a cell, and within a day, thousands of viruses may come out. By the 1950s, virologists had grasped these fundamental facts. But that understanding did not bring virology to a halt. For one thing, virologists knew little about the many different ways in which viruses make us sick. They didn't know why papillomaviruses can cause horns to grow on rabbits and cause hundreds of thousands of cases of cervical cancer each year. They didn't know what made some viruses deadly and others relatively harmless. They had yet to learn how viruses evade the defenses of their hosts and how they evolve faster than anything else on the planet. In the 1950s, they did not know that a virus had spread decades earlier from chimpanzees and other primates into humans, a virus that would go on to become one of the greatest killers in history, known as HIV. Nor could they predict that in 2020, a new virus called SARS-CoV-2 would sweep the planet, plunging the global economy into its worst crisis since the Great Depression. In the 1950s, scientists also didn't know how important viruses are beyond disease. They could not have dreamed of the vast number of viruses that exist on Earth. They could not have guessed that much of life's genetic diversity is carried in viruses. They did not know that viruses help produce much of the oxygen we breathe and help control the planet's thermostat. And they certainly would not have guessed that the human genome is partly composed from thousands of viruses that infected our distant ancestors, or that life as we know it may have gotten its start 4 billion years ago from viruses. Now, scientists know these things, or, to be more precise, they know of these things. They now recognize that from the cave of crystals to our own interiors, Earth is a planet of viruses. Their understanding is still rough, but it is a start. So let us start as well. Old Companions. The Uncommon Cold: How Rhinoviruses Gently Conquered the World. Around 3,500 years ago, an Egyptian physician sat down and wrote the oldest known medical text. Among the diseases he described was something called rash. Even with that strange-sounding name, its symptoms, a cough and a flowing of mucus from the nose, are immediately familiar to us all. Rash is the common cold. Some viruses that beset us today are new to humanity. Other viruses are obscure and exotic. But human rhinoviruses, the chief cause of the common cold, are old companions. It's been estimated that every human being on Earth will spend a year of his or her life lying in bed, sick with colds. The human rhinovirus is, in other words, one of the most successful viruses of all. Before the discovery of rhinoviruses, doctors floundered to explain the cause of colds. Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician, blamed an imbalance of the humors. 2,000 years later, in the early 1900s, our knowledge of colds hadn't improved much. The physiologist Leonard Hill declared that colds were caused by walking outside in the morning. In 1914, a German microbiologist named Walther Kruse gained the first solid clue about the origin of colds by having a snuffly assistant blow his nose. Kruse mixed the assistant's mucus into a salt solution, poured it through a filter, and then put a few drops of the filtered fluid into the noses of 12 colleagues. 4 of them came down with colds. Later, Kruse did the same thing to 36 students, and 15 of them got sick. While he ran this experiment, Kruse also kept track of 35 people who didn't get the drops. Only one of them came down with a cold of their own. Cruz's experiments made it clear that the drops from people with colds contained a tiny pathogen that was responsible for the disease. At first, many experts believed it was some kind of bacteria, but the American physician Alphonse Daucher ruled that out in 1927. He filtered the mucus from people with colds, just as Bergerac had filtered tobacco plant sap 30 years before. Even with the bacteria removed, the fluid could still make people sick. Only a virus could have slipped through Daucher's filters. It took another 3 decades before scientists figured out exactly which viruses had slipped through. The most common of them are known as human rhinoviruses. Rhino means nose. Rhinoviruses are remarkably simple. While we humans have about 20,000 genes, rhinoviruses have only 10. And yet this haiku of genetic information is enough to let rhinoviruses invade our bodies, outwit our immune system, and produce new viruses that can escape to new hosts. To get to those new hosts, rhinoviruses travel in droplets. They can get into the tiny ones that we exhale with each breath. They can get into the bigger droplets we blast out when we sneeze or cough. A careless wipe of the nose can put those droplets on our hands, and our hands can transfer them to doorknobs, elevator buttons, and other surfaces where other people can pick them up on their own hands, which can then deliver them to their own noses. Once inside a fresh nose, rhinoviruses can latch onto the cells that line the nasal passage. They slip inside and use their host cells to make copies of their genetic material along with protein shells to hold them. The host cell then rips apart, and the new rhinoviruses escape. In some hosts, rhinoviruses remain limited to the nose, but in others, they slip into the throat and even the lungs. Rhinoviruses infect relatively few cells, causing little real harm. So why can they cause such miserable experiences? We have only ourselves to blame. Infected cells release signaling molecules called cytokines, which attract nearby immune cells. Those immune cells then make us feel awful. They create inflammation that triggers a scratchy feeling in the throat and leads to the production of mucus around the site of the infection. In order to recover from a cold, we have to wait not only for the immune system to wipe out the virus, but also for the immune system itself to calm down. In ancient Egypt, physicians treated rash by dabbing a mixture of honey, herbs, and incense around the nose. 15 centuries later, the Roman scholar Pliny the Elder recommended rubbing a mouse against the nose instead. In 17th-century Europe, some physicians used a blend of gunpowder and eggs, others a mixture of suet and fried cow dung. Leonard Hill recommended starting the day with a cold shower. None of these treatments worked, but even today we lack a proven cure for the common cold. In the late 1900s, some researchers got encouraged by the discovery that zinc could stop rhinoviruses from infecting cells grown in petri dishes. Before long, drugstores were selling zinc tablets without a prescription, even though no one had yet shown that they worked in actual people. Some small clinical studies later hinted that zinc might cut a cold down by a couple days. But when a Finnish scientist named Harry Hemela led a carefully designed trial on 253 volunteers, he found no benefit. In fact, Hemela reported in 2019 the volunteers who took zinc tablets took a little longer to recover from a cold than people who took sugar pills. Other common treatments for the cold may not only be useless, they may even cause harm. Parents often give children cough syrup for colds, but studies show it doesn't make people get better faster. In fact, cough syrup poses a wide variety of rare yet serious side effects, such as convulsions, rapid heart rate, and even death. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration warns that children under the age of 2 who get colds the most often should not take cough syrup. It's also a mistake to treat a cold with antibiotics. antibiotics are designed to kill bacteria and are useless against
Sample complete. Ready to continue?